All right. Hey guys, I am not Amy Hall, so don't change the station. Don't shut off the podcast. My name is John Noyes. I'm a newer-ish member to the Stand the Reason team.
He's the probie.
And I'm on trial, so I hope I do okay. This is the first time I've gotten the opportunity to host STR Asks with Greg Kokel, and it's an honor and a privilege. I can only pretend to stand in for Amy Hall, but I'm going to do my best. How are you doing, Greg?
I'm doing fine, buddy. Ready to rock and roll.
I am ready to go. So how about we just kick off the first question? It's from Peter, and this is a really interesting question. If we're not responsible for the sins of our fathers or ancestors, why am I responsible for Adam and Eve's original sin?
Well, I think that's, as we often get on this program, John, really challenging question. I talk about it a little bit in the story of reality, and there are classically two ways of characterizing it. Let me begin by saying this. The lack of responsibility for being punished for somebody else's sins, it's talked about in Jeremiah and some other places, means that an individual child of a person doesn't get punished for the crimes of that parent, all right? Mm-hmm. And so they don't go after the kid for what the parent did, okay? This is not quite the same situation we're facing here. What we're facing here is a large group, okay? And the large group is humanity being represented by Adam and Eve in this regard. And so here I want to shift the illustration and put it in a little different fashion. In World War II, when we were attacked by the Japanese, we declared war against the Japanese. When I say we, it was the president, and then the Congress went along with it. The people in the country didn't say anything. We didn't have a vote. There wasn't a plebiscite. There wasn't a democratic process, a strictly democratic process. There was a representative republic, and those who represent us made a decision for us and engaged all of the country in a war effort in which individual people gave their lives towards that end. And they gave their lives because, in the case of the Pacific Theater, the Japanese, who had bombed Pearl Harbor, killed American soldiers. Okay, why did they kill American soldiers? Because we had declared war on them. Well, the soldiers didn't, but the country did by its leaders. So there is a concept here that we all understand it's in play now that is a representative element here, a headship. When a leader of a nation or even a father of a family makes decisions regarding their constituency, so to speak, those people who they have responsibility over, those decisions affect those under them. They are party to them. It isn't so much that American soldiers in the Pacific Theater were being punished by the Japanese because their fathers, that is, their leaders, had declared war in Japan. It was because we as a country were at war with Japan. In the case of the fall, something, at least the way one argument goes, and this is what I characterize more in the story of reality, this is what has happened here. There is a point of view that says, well, we were all actually rebelling in Adam, insofar as the whole race was in Adam when he rebelled, and therefore we were actively, maybe not passively, but in a way that's morally responsible, participating in the rebellion of Adam. He not only rebelled, we did too, in his loins, as it were. This is not at all persuasive to me. However, this is one way that people have tried to make sense out of the corporate guilt that we inherit from Adam. Actually, strictly speaking, on that view, we wouldn't be inheriting it from Adam. We are, in fact, the guilty ones being born in guilt that we are responsible for individually. But like I said, I'm not persuaded by that. I think the other explanation than what I've been characterizing here with the war illustration is more persuasive. It makes more sense because we have analogs in our own culture. Now, keep in mind, too, that what happened at the fall, I'm trying to think of the best way to characterize this, that what happened at the fall is a kind of moral brokenness took place. So the way I explain it in the story of reality, as a kind of a way to make it handy and understandable, it's not maybe theologically profound, but I just say when Adam and Eve disobey God, they broke the world and everything in it, all the relationships and all the people. And because they reproduce after their own kind, they, being now broken rebels against God and guilty, reproduce those like themselves. So strictly speaking, the children aren't just being punished for the crimes of the parents. They are like the parents because of the brokenness that the fall resulted in, and are doing the same things that the parents are responsible for. And so when our judgment comes, when humanity's judgment comes, it says in Revelations 20 that the books are open.
Yeah.
And what are the books? They're a record of our deeds. So the things that are going to be, we are going to be judged by are the very things that we did wrong ourselves, not that Adam did wrong. Now, I'm not saying that we don't carry a corporate guilt. I mean, that's good theology. But what I want to point out is that that is, we are born into iniquity. David makes this clear in Psalm 51. But we also are being judged there at the great white throne judgment for our own crimes against humanity, against others, before God. And that's what's being listed. We are being judged according to our works. So I do think this is a challenging kind of circumstance. And I it's one of the things that I struggle with, too. I mean, I wish we all had the same chance that Adam had. You know, yeah, is, they could have sinned or they could not have sinned, and it's just completely, in that sense, up to them. But that isn't the case anymore. And the fact is there are consequences in other people's lives that are as a result of some different people's sin. And this is what we face here. What I think, for those who are uncomfortable about this, just keep in mind that the final judgment is going to be based on our own crimes against God, and that becomes clear when you read the text.
Yeah, I think that's a really good answer. I think that's a really good answer, especially drawing the distinction between we're not being punished for Adam's sins. Adam broke everything. You know, that's the result is, but we're not being punished for Adam's, you know, thoughts or Adam's actions or how he failed in whatever he was doing. We're being punished for our own sins.
Right.
But he broke the system.
Yeah, and our sinning is clearly a consequence in some sense of the fall that Adam and Eve are responsible for. We don't know what we would have done if we would have been just like Adam. A lot of people say, well, you know, we would have done the same thing he did. Well, I don't know. I don't know if that's the case. But I think the key here is that there's no injustice because the crimes that we are being punished for are our own crimes and not the subsequent sins of Adam that he committed after the fall, like you pointed out, John.
Yeah, that's, I think, a really good answer. Thanks. Mm-hmm. And so now we have another question coming from Sam in Australia, which is crazy. It's as far away. Is eternity to be understood as God restoring the original plan? Would Adam's body have been the same as our or Jesus' resurrected glorified body? And the third part to this question is paradise lost and restored like a mirror?
I'm not sure what that last part means. I think that, and help me out if I misunderstand this, John.
Sure.
But it sounds like the general question is, are we going to be restored the way it was at the beginning, or is this going to be better than what the original plan was? Is that the gist of it?
Yeah, I think that's what he's getting. Is heaven going to be just like the garden pre-fall, or are there going to be differences?
Well, this is a lot depends on what he has in mind when he says just like the garden pre-fall. It's not going to be just like that in a certain sense, because the whole world is different. Everything has been influenced by the fall, and even we have been influenced by the fall. That is, in heaven, in our eternal state, let's put it that way, because we're going to spend that on earth, it looks like to me, in a new heavens and a new earth, in a resurrected body. But the individuals in the eternal state are going to have qualities that Adam and Eve, if they had stayed unfallen, could never have, because these are virtues and qualities that could only be developed in the context of a fallen world. Okay, so the things are going to be different than they would have been if there were no fall. Also, I think just when we reflect on why would God allow these kinds of bad things to happen when he could have prevented them, at least in principle, so the argument goes, and it's kind of a version of the complaint about the problem of evil. Why would a good God allow? And the answer is, well, he could allow that if he had a good, morally sufficient reason. That means if he could have prevented a greater harm or provided for a greater good. And so I think that's the circumstance. I think the in the long run, there's going to be a greater good that will accrue than if there had been no fall to begin with. Well, what's that greater good? I don't know. That's in God's mind. He's got his own plans, and he's talked a little bit about that. We can read about it, but we don't get much detail. And I can't tell you what's the greater good of every single incident of evil in the earth. That is not answerable. Only God knows that. But it's not hard to imagine how God would allow evil for a time to provide for a greater good in the long term. And in fact, that is the solution to the deductive problem of evil that most people offer. If God were good, he would want to get rid of evil. If he were all evil, if he were powerful, he'd be able, but there's evil, so what's up with God, kind of thing. Well, the problem with that way of thinking is that it is not the case that if God were good, he wouldn't allow any evil, because it, in principle, seems like there's possibility that a good God could allow evil for a morally sufficient reason. And this is why philosophers have largely abandoned that argument. Even atheistic philosophers, they have other complaints, but that's one they realize they can't sustain. So there was a portion of the question, John, that had to do with Jesus' resurrected body. So what was that again?
So he was asking, would Adam's body have been the same as our or Jesus' resurrected / glorified body?
So, no, I don't think so. Adam had a normal human, in a certain sense, mortal body.
That's right.
And we don't know a lot about the qualities of it, but Jesus was a very, very, the resurrected Christ was very different. As it says in 1 Corinthians 15, the mortal puts on the immortal in the resurrection, and it's kind of hard. Paul struggles there trying to explain exactly what that's like, and he spends a lot of time in 1 Corinthians 15 with, for me, a bunch of confusing language, you know, but because there's a mystery there.
Yeah.
So it's hard to say what it's going to be like entirely, but we know it's not the same as Adam and Eve's body at creation.
Yeah, and I think that's a really good answer. One of the things that stood out to me in his, in Sam's first question is eternity to be understood as God restoring the original plan? But it's not so much restoring the original plan. This is God's original plan. God's original plan included the fall. And so I think that when we have that understanding, sometimes these questions, not so much that they get answered, but we become maybe more comfortable with them,
mm-hmm.
Because the fall, Adam's fall, had to happen.
It didn't catch God by surprise. I'm not sure if I want to put it had to happen, but I think you're right in saying that it was part of the larger plan that God was unfolding in light of what was going to happen, what did happen. And pardon me, I think that's the important part.
Yeah, me too. And we've got a time for, I think, one more. And this one is actually, I really like this one because it gets us maybe a little bit away from theology and into something out in the world that people might be wondering about. Jared Bolis asks this. He says, what do you think of the claim, history is written by the winners? Does this mean anything from the historicity of does this mean anything for the historicity of the biblical record?
Well, I'm familiar with the phrase. Lots of people have heard it. History is written by the winners. Yeah. And first of all, it's a generalization that has some value, and that means that the winners, whatever that exactly means, I'm not entirely sure. They might be referring to specific kinds of conflicts like wars. And so the one who wins the war is the one who writes about the war in a way that makes them look good.
Sure.
So this is an assertion that the record is distorted by people who have a reason to distort it. Okay, that's what the assertion is in this. And I can see that it's a reasonable concern, because distortion does happen by people who have reasons to distort. However, that doesn't mean that it always happens, that distortion always takes place, okay? And and even when you have winners, you still have other sources, especially in modern times, that can talk about the other side, as it were, and they do share about the other side. So I guess I wouldn't accept the notion that history is always written by the winners, basically.
Yeah.
For one, it's not even clear what winner means in most circumstances. In a war, yes. In all the other circumstances, I don't know. So we have a history of the Depression. Oh, that was written by the winners. Who would that be?
Yeah, yeah.
You know? And when it comes to the Gospels, which is the concern and application here,
that's right.
We don't have to worry, because the generalization isn't always true. Okay? So we don't have to say, well, this is a truism that must apply to our record. How do we know it applies to our record? We have to look at the record to see if we have good reason to believe from the internal evidence and external evidence whether there has been, in fact, distortion. You see, somebody just, and this is a warning here, a critic just waving the wand over any historical account saying, well, the winners write the history. That doesn't discredit the account just because they say that. What they have to do is they got to demonstrate that any particular account was distorted, okay?
Yeah.
And that requires looking at both the internal and external evidence, not looking at who supposedly won. And by the way, who won in this particular case?
Yeah, that's what I was going to point out.
The Gospels, even by the most liberal account, were written before the persecution of Christians ended. That didn't happen until Constantine in 325.
Yeah.
And Vespasian, just before him, I think that was the guy. I sometimes get these emperors mixed up, because all of them were nasty, as most of them were. Man, he was a brutal executor of Christians in the first part of the 4th century. Now, what Constantine did is he didn't make Christianity the religion of the realm. He just made it legal.
Yeah.
That's all he did. Well, big deal, but that's all he did. Okay? Which means for 400 years almost, about 400 years exactly, Christians were the losers.
Yeah.
But this is when the Gospels were being written. So why would anybody think that the Gospels couldn't be trusted in virtue of this aphorism that the winners always write history? First of all, it's not true that the winners always write history. And secondly, the Christians writing this history weren't the winners at the time that they did the writing.
Yeah,
so I don't think there's anything to fear from that.
I really like the way that you just categorized that and summarized it. There's two takeaways here. Is the first is that even if it was shown that the winners are the ones who write history, it doesn't necessarily mean the history they're writing is false.
Right.
And then also with the biblical account, who are we talking about as far as winners? Because it wasn't the first evangelists. It wasn't disciples. I mean, Paul wasn't a winner
right.
by any measure of modern expectations.
That's right.
And even so, look what's written in the accounts. I mean, so many embarrassing facts are written about them. I mean, if I were Peter and I was a winner in quotes, I certainly wouldn't want half of the stuff that's written about me in there.
You wouldn't want to record Jesus calling you Satan.
Yeah.
Basically, you know, not very complimentary.
No, it doesn't bode well for your popularity, yeah. You know, in the historical context.
Or denying your Savior Master three times in public with an oath.
Yeah, I mean, all that, having Paul come to rebuke you because you're not preaching right. Proper gospel anymore. Yeah. I mean, these things just aren't. I don't want them said about me now. Never mind being a father of the faith.
So those would be classic loser lines.
Yeah, they
in
are.
The text.
Yeah, that's really
we
good.
Should
insight.
Call them that loser lines. That's usually called embarrassing details, but those are good loser lines.
Loser lines.
Unlikely that those would be invented.
I love it. And with that, we're going to close this episode of STR Ask. We're going to end it. And I want to remind everybody who's listening, I know I don't sound nearly as good as Amy, but you can still ask your questions and Amy will get them. Just go to our Twitter account and it's hashtag STR Ask and we'll get those for you. And we'd love to interact with you through those. So we'll hear from you. Well, I guess you'll hear from us on the next podcast.
Right.